There's another chair over there.
Yeah.
Kitchen chair or whatever.
Okay, again, if you could just...
All right, testing one, testing okay. Two, testing three.
Okay, that's good. All right, I think we're ready to roll.
And that's the director's chair, right?
Perfect. okay, one of the things I like to do when I'm interviewing people about the loft is I like to ask, find out more about your background, you know, just how you ended up there and things like that. So I might ask you some questions that seem kind of unrelated to the loft, but about your music career.
Sure,
if that's okay.
It's whatever you want, man. I want to make this as easy for you as possible.
Okay. And the other thing I like to do, just so that there'll never be a mistake on these tapes, is if we could just start by you saying your name and where we are.
I'm Frank Amos. We're at my home in Santa Ana, California. Today is June the 19th, 2003. And we're going to reminisce about my days in the loft at 821 6th Avenue in 1961, 42 years ago.
That's perfect. Where are you from originally, Frank?
I'm from Baltimore, Maryland.
Was there music in your family?
My Uncle Bud came home from the Second World War and bought a brand new set of Singerland drums, and I was about 11 years old, and I saw them and just fell in love with them, and that's all I wanted to do from then on, was learn how to play the drums, and I did. I did it through high school and started playing professionally when I was 15. Had my own little band in Baltimore called the Harmonaires, and we played for rec centers and churches and all kinds of dances and weddings, and I did that until I went into the Army when I was 19, played in the 9th Army Band in Fairbanks, Alaska, and came home to Baltimore, worked around town for a while, and in early 1960, I went on the road with a band named Dean Hudson. It was a big band, and we traveled, did one-nighters all through the South for a year, and when that band broke up, I decided to go to New York City, and one of the first days I was there, I ran into a bass player who had played for a while with Dean Hudson. His name was Dave Sibley. And he told me about the loft where he was living, and they were having constant sessions there, and invited me to come, which I did. And in those days, you had to go down to the corner of 6th Avenue and 28th Street, where there was a phone booth, and call to the loft, and someone would open the window and throw a key out down to the sidewalk. And that was the way to get in and go upstairs to play. There was no other way to let anyone in. They always had to call up and get a key thrown out the window.
Who would you call?
Whoever answered the phone. You know, you would call there to the loft, right. Whatever.
What floor? Do you remember what floor?
We were on the fifth floor.
Fifth floor.
Yeah. Hall Overton was on the fourth floor.
Right.
And we were on the fifth floor. Actually, the loft was owned by a painter whose name escapes me at the moment. I know you know who he is because...
David Young.
David Young, yes, who was at the time living in Cape Cod.
Right.
And we used to send him the rent every month.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Well, actually, it was the rent on the loft, I think David paid... The rent on the loft was $50 a month. And we had to pay the rent of $50 a month to a... There was a place across 6th Avenue where we paid it in cash. And then we had to send David another $50 a month. So he was actually making $50 a month on it, and it was costing us, two guys would always stay there and cost us $50 a month to live there.
What year were you born?
1936.
Okay. So you played with the Dean Hudson Band until you were 25?
No, I only played with the Dean Hudson Band 1 year.
Okay.
And that's true. When I went to New York in 1961, I would have been 25. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was in the Army from the time I was 19 to 21. And then I played around Baltimore for maybe a year or two. Then I went to Washington, D.C. I got a job in Washington, D.C. And that's where I met someone who put me in touch with Dean Hudson. And I joined his band in April of 1960, or March or April of 1960. And then I spent that year with him before he broke the band up and decided to move to Atlanta. And I almost went there with him, because if I had moved to Atlanta, he could have kept me working. But I always thought, and I really do still think, that New York's the top of the world, so I went there.
Yeah. At what point did you make a conscious decision, or was it a conscious decision, to become a professional musician? How old were you?
Oh, you know, in my teens, 15 or so, you know, I started taking drum lessons from Joe Levitt, who was the percussionist with the National Symphony, when I was about 12. And actually, I studied with him up until the time I went in the Army. And that was just my dream. That's what I wanted to do. Once I latched onto it, I never even thought of doing it as a hobby. I just thought of this is what I want to do, and this is what I want to prove that I can do. It was always a matter of me to prove that I can do this. Mm-hmm. And in light of how many people told me how hard it was, mm-hmm. of my family, because there were other than my uncle, who was not really a blood relative, no one else in my family was ever a musician, and it was something I wanted to do. And all the warnings of what a tough life and impossible to make a living out of it made me want to do it more. And plus, I loved the life, and I loved playing drums with a band. It was a wonderful feeling.
Did you have any family pressure to have a so-called,
a real job?
Straight life job?
I would say a day job, not really. They were really, really good about it. You know, I mean, my dad and mom, you know, or mainly my dad, would warn me that it's a hard. Chances are of overcoming all the hardships of being a musician, you know, the chances were against me, but they never did anything to make it you know, impossible or really hard for me to do. As much as they would have rather I did something else, they would have rather that I worked at the dairy where my father worked, you know.
Yeah.
Secure job. My brother, I have a brother who's just he's just a year and a half younger than I, and he was with the Baltimore County Police Department until he retired, and he used to always say he could never understand how I could have a life that I didn't know where next week's job was coming from. You know, not to have a steady steady income and a steady job that you knew it was always going to be there. They couldn't understand how. Couldn't understand that way of life, but and it isn't something you decide to do when you become when you do become a musician and pursue that career. That's just the way your life becomes, and you find ways, you know, to cope with not having a steady income.
Right.
And you just have to. It's a matter of coping with not having a steady income. I think it's coping with the insecurity, you know, like, okay, so I don't have, you know, the insecurity, but I'm doing what I want to do, and that's the price I'm willing to pay.
Right.
And to take it a step further, I did that till I was, you know, that was my life until I'm 67 now. 12 years ago, I became president of the Musicians Union, which is a pretty secure job. Other than I have to be reelected every 2 years, but I have been reelected every 2 years. And even then, when the opportunity came for that job, when it was offered to me, I was elected vice president. And then shortly after that, the president died, and I was expected to be the president. And I was not willing to give up playing. I said, no, if I have to give up playing, which at the time was a condition of the job, I says, I won't take the job as president because I'm a player and that's what I've always had been. So the executive board and the rest of the union, we changed our bylaws so that I could continue to play and still be president. And then that's in 12 years. And then, of course, when I'm working steady as a musician's union, every year my playing became a little less. We're right now, it's down to maybe 15, 20 times a year is what I play. I'm getting ready to play now for a 4th of July concert. I have a 15-piece band, and I'm having a couple of rehearsals, and that's why you see the pile of music over there. I'm getting the arrangements ready for the guys, and we've had one rehearsal, and we'll have one more, and we'll do another concert. So my playing has, you know, dropped off, but I never would have just quit playing, you know, right, to take the union job.
Right.
It's been a natural progression, and I like my job as the union, as the union president. I've always, when I first started playing in Baltimore, as soon as I was old enough, I joined the union, and I've always believed that the musicians union was one of the things that we have going for us in a business where there's no security. To get any hint of security, it's going to take something like organizing, and the musicians union was there to do that. So I've always been a part of that.
Do the local unions interact at all, or do you interact with Bill Crow?
I interact with Bill just on a more or less I read his articles and I submit a little anecdote to him every once in a while, and he's printed them in his column, the band room.
Right.
He's printed three or four of things of mine over the years that I've sent him. But we interact with the other unions around here. Mm-hmm. There's a local in San Diego, and there's a local in Long Beach, and there's naturally the Los Angeles local. And once a month, in fact, today we would have usually had what we call our monthly area locals meeting, where we all get together. We go to Local 47. The president of the San Diego local takes the Amtrak to Santa Ana, and I pick him up there, and we drive to L.A. to the Hollywood local. And the president of the Long Beach local comes, and the president of Ventura and Santa Barbara, not always the president, the secretary treasurer, but we have our monthly area locals meeting, and we do just do that, you know,
yeah.
Visit and talk about how interact with what we're doing for the on a area basis.
Right.
Now, we didn't do it today because Sunday we'll be in Las Vegas to start our convention. So we just decided to skip this week because we'll all be together Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at the Riviera Hotel for our convention. So we do interact, and there'll be a lot of business there, bylaw changes and dues changes and things like that for 3 days.
That's interesting.
Even when I came out here years ago, I was a member just of the, I ran for the musicians' executive board, and I was on the executive board probably 10 years before I ran for vice president, the president's request, and then I was elected vice president. And I say shortly after that, he died. And so I've always had, even in New York, I always went to the meetings. You know, they used to have the meetings. At the time, the local 802 was on 52nd Street, and there used to be a dance hall across 8th Avenue. I think it's still there. I was there in December. It's not a dance hall anymore, but for a while it was a dance hall, and they would have their union meetings there, and I would always attend them and vote, and you know, I always was active in that mm-hmm. that part of our business.
Dave Sibley, do you know where he is now?
You know, I looked up a Dave Sibley and it turned up in Dayton, Ohio. And I'm not sure if it's him or not. I never double checked it.
Okay.
See, I have access in my position as a union to the AFM database.
Yeah.
And I just have a name if I put in. And I looked up Dave a couple years ago, and it came up in Dayton, Ohio. And I've never followed up on it.
Okay, I might try that. Mm-hmm. There is a Dave Sibley David Sibley, who's a famous bird book author. He writes bird books.
Yeah.
And I wondered if there was any chance that it could be him.
Well, you know, when I knew him, he never had that interest.
Okay,
you know.
That's probably not him.
Yeah.
So you moved to New York, and you already knew Dave from the Hudson Band?
Yeah, he was a bass player on the Dean Hudson Band when I first joined it. And then he got a call to go with, I don't recall the name of the band leader, but it was a well-known sort of traditional Dixieland kind of a band that he went with. And the name escapes me right now. And so he left the band. And then I was in New York just a matter of days, and I ran into Dave at the Union. We used to go to the Union that had we just called it the hall, going to the Union. It used to be on the dance floor at Roseland, because the Union was upstairs. The Union musicians, 802 offices, were on the second floor in the Roseland building. So Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, they would open the floor, you know, the actual dance floor, and all the musicians would gather there. They used to call it the exchange floor. And we'd gather there, and the people there were looking for musicians would come there and hire musicians. And, if you know, you would go there and just, again, interact and network with each other and get work. I got a number of jobs from going to the Union. Wednesday was the big day. Monday and Friday were just a few people went, but on Wednesday that was for people that needed things, you know, musicians for the weekend. That was just the right timing. Mm-hmm. If you didn't have a job by Friday, there were chances of getting one on going to the Union and getting one weren't very, very good. But Wednesday, there was a lot of people there looking for musicians. Mm-hmm. And I went there, and that's where I ran into Dave, and he told me about the loft.
When he first told you about it, was it in regard to there being a vacancy? Or
no, just come down and play, you know. It was just this place where I'm living, and we're having sessions there every night, and come on down. And I think I went that night.
Do you remember who was there that night?
You know, guys like Pete Yellen, Ronnie Cooper. And I'm not sure if they were there that night, but they were the guys that were coming, you know, in those days. And that first night is rather hazy in my memory. I was old, actually. You know, I was new in town, and there's all these. Much of them were much harder bebopper type musicians than I was, but I was game, mm-hmm. And I wanted to play. You know, I wasn't as dedicated a jazz player as a lot of the guys that came to the loft. My idea of like the top job in New York was playing Broadway show. And most of the guys that came to the loft, their idea was like just some kind of jazz gig, just playing jazz no matter what the conditions, you know. Yeah, so, but then I know it helped my playing a lot in those months to go in there and play with these guys and just play out for hours and hours. Right. And yeah.
How long did it take? How did the arrangement come about for you to move in?
For me to move in. When Dave was sharing the loft with Gary Hawkins. And just a week or two when I first started going there, Gary got a job in Bermuda. So it was Dave's choice to have someone to share it with. So he chose me. He asked me if I wanted, you know, to take over and Gary's half, which I did. There was a famous old hotel called the Nevada Hotel on Broadway and 70th Street, which is like, you know, one of these $12 a week and bathroom in a hall kind of hotel.
Right.
And that's where when I first went to New York, I started living there. It's long torn down, but a lot of people lived at the Nevada, a lot of musicians.
Now, when you moved in, do you remember the arrangement of the fourth and third floors and second and first floors? You know, what was on the first floor? What was on
The first floor, there was some sort of like electronics shop right on the first floor. That's very hazy in my memory, right? You know, like the storefront, mm-hmm. And then the opening to the loft was off to the side. It seems to me it was some sort of hardware or electronics kind of store.
Okay.
And then Gene was like second, third floor. And then the hall was on the fourth floor. And then we were on the fifth floor.
What do you remember about Gene Smith?
He was very eccentric. I mean, you know, I mean, not that I hung out with Gene that much. You know, I would just walk past him on going up to, you know, going up the stairs, and he would come up and hear us play. And I say he's eccentric, but I can't tell you any eccentricities that he exhibited. Just he had that aura about him of artist and like just being living somewhat of a chaotic life. And I, at the time, I wasn't even aware of his fame. I knew he was a photographer, and I wasn't aware much more than that. I was all focused on the fifth floor.
Right.
And I knew he had the recording equipment, you know, I just knew that was Gene's microphone sticking out of the ceiling. So I never like hung out with him or really knew much about his life.
Did he hang out at all during the sessions? Do you remember that at all?
Very little. I mean, he would be up there. He would come up sometimes, but he wouldn't be there he wouldn't be there once a week. If he would come up, whatever, if he was in a mood to come up and just watch, because he was always listening through his sound equipment. So he didn't hang out in upstairs on the fifth floor.
How long did Dave Sibley live there?
Well, I don't know how long I really don't know how long the loft was in operation before I came to town, which was April of 61, and I really don't know how long Dave was there, but it was about he had a girlfriend that came down, he met in Boston. Dave at the time was playing with Frankie Randall. He used to be, at the time he was calling himself Chico Randall, and they were playing at Jilly's on 52nd Street. And they had gone to Boston, and Dave met a girl in Boston, and she would come down and visit him at the loft. And very shortly, a matter of maybe a couple months or maybe a month, they got married, and Dave moved to Boston, and that's when he moved out. So that I came to New York in April. By the 1st of June, Dave was gone. You know, in the middle of May, it happened really quickly. Gary left, and I took over with Dave. And just a matter of weeks, Dave had moved to Boston. And that's when I got Jimmy Stevenson.
How did you know Jimmy?
Because he used to come there and play. And at the time, he seemed one of the more stable people.
And Sandy was with him by then?
She was still in Detroit, but she did come to town. It was his girlfriend from Detroit, because he hadn't been in town long either. And then she, very shortly after that, moved to New York.
Oh, explain the rent situation again, who you guys were paying to.
Right. We sent David Young $50 a month to Cape Cod, and we also paid $50 a month. The rent on the place was $50 a month, and there was some shop across 6th Avenue that was like a cashier's window.
Yeah.
And a little we would, once a month, he'd give them I don't know whether they were the owners or they were the representative of the owners.
I think they were the owners.
And we
had a guy named Al S. Formies.
Yeah. See, I don't know. I'm no names. I just know.
What I'm curious about is how Dave Young got $50 out of that.
That was just a deal he made with someone long before I came.
Okay.
You know, and that was the deal. We sent we gave $50 to the guy across the street and $50 to Dave Young. And I think when Jimmy Stevenson moved in there, I think he stopped giving the money to Dave Young. And they and he made his own deal with whoever the owner was, because I don't know whether Dave had a lease or maybe that coincided. I don't say when Jimmy moved in, but when I moved out and Jimmy and Sandy had a baby and made more of a home of it. For a while, Sandy lived out in Long Island, and then she became pregnant, and they made the loft into a much homier place than it ever was before, Jimmy made his own deal with whoever owned the place. And again, I don't know whether that coincided with a lease being, you know, the lease being up or whatever. But I do remember she told me that he stopped paying David Young.
What do you remember about Hall Overton?
That he was he was there, and he was I just always heard that he was a avant-garde type composer, very modern music, and I again didn't hang out with him much.
Yeah, you didn't see him much.
I mean, I would be coming upstairs, and I would run into him on the stairway, or Alan Zoot used to go to his loft a lot, and I come home. I remember coming home late one night and Zoot come bouncing out of there, just bouncing out of Hall's place, and they had probably, it looked like been partying, and he said something to me where it made me think that he thought that I was Al Cohn. And then he went on down the stairs, but it was the guys that came to the fifth floor loft were like, a lot of people were living on the streets. There was one guy named Lynn Holiday that used to come to the loft, and he was like penniless. He was a good saxophone player. Everyone loved him, but he had heroin problems, and he had a girlfriend that was with him. I think her name was June. I'm not sure of her name. But she and Lynn were just living on the streets, and this was the summertime, and sometimes they'd be barefoot. And I can remember when she finally got fed up. She was at my loft one morning waiting. She had called some guy from whatever town she was from. I think it was Chicago, and he was coming to pick her up. And we waited, looking out onto Sixth Avenue, till this guy drove up. And as I recall, he drove up in a Porsche, and she went with him and went back home. She had finally had enough. But she had been on the streets with Lynn, from when I first started going to the loft, which was April. And it was finally, I think, when like was starting to get cold in that fall, when she finally decided she was had enough of living on the streets. And she came home, she had called this guy and given her that address, and she waited there looking out the window one morning for a few hours till we finally drove up and she left with him. But that was Lynn. I don't know what I'm getting mixed up with Detroit or Chicago, but she went back to she finally went home.
That's very interesting. And Lynn was a pretty good player.
Yeah, he was a very good player, but he was strung out from one, and with heroin, and just couldn't. I remember one time going to an audition and getting ready for going a road trip with the Billy May Band, and it was a singer by the name of Frankie Lester was actually the leader of it, and we all went to the first rehearsal, and Lynn had been hired, but Frankie was the leader, says that he wasn't going to allow Lynn on the band because he could tell that he was strung out, and we were only going out for a weekend, but Lynn made the rehearsal and they replaced him. He was a good player, but he just was really, really strong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was at the loft a lot because he had no, he had nowhere to live.
Nowhere else to go.
I came home one time, I opened my door and with my key, and there's Lynn and his girlfriend making out, having sex on my bed. And I didn't have any idea how they got in there. Then they knew that if you kept going up the steps, it goes to the roof, and they go out on the roof and then down the fire escape and come into my window. I didn't even know that, but they knew that, and they were in my bedroom when I got home. So I'm sure they knew places like that all over town where they could sneak in or find their way around. Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. You mentioned Ronnie Free earlier. Do you remember him being there then?
Well, no, Ronnie had already... I met Ronnie in the summer of 1960, and I'm sure it was Charleston, South Carolina, and he had left New York by that time. Mm-hmm. And I was traveling with that band, that Dean Hudson band, and we were playing, whatever beach, some kind of beach, might even have been Myrtle Beach, but that may not be that close to Charleston. But I met Ronnie there, and we had some jam sessions, and then when I went, I was at the Loft, I heard his name, you know, people mentioned his name.
What did they say?
Oh, that he had, again, was another person, had got strung out and had to leave town. When I met him, he told me he had a nervous breakdown. And in fact, it was Gene Smith I remember Gene saying that, well, nervous breakdown is what they say is their way of explaining it, but he really just got strung out behind drugs and was out running. I think he told me he was out running on Sixth Avenue, and he had to be physically taken and for his own protection or something. Maybe that was his nervous breakdown. I remember Gene telling me that.
Yeah, wow. Did Gene say anything else about him?
No.
Because Ronnie lived in Gene's floor for like over a year. Slept on his recliner.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently.
Yeah. See, I didn't know that, yeah. But I do remember it was when I said something about Ronnie Free having a nervous breakdown. I remember specifically it was Gene that was saying that's just what they called it. You know, it was really a drug problem. Mm-hmm. But I had met Ronnie after that, and he was like playing well and looking well. You know, back in Charleston.
He's still around now. I mean, he's told me that story.
Uh-huh.
And he was he was picked up by the police. Walking the streets.
Mm-hmm.
Probably that same night that you're referring.
Yeah. To. Wait, Gene. It's funny. Gene never told me much, but I can remember that. Well, he made it sound like he was out like running between traffic or something, you know, and creating a hazard to him and everyone else.
Right. Now, who else do you remember?
Sonny Clark. Mm-hmm. Sonny Clark used to be there a lot. Sonny was very, very mellow. He was naturally another junkie type guy, but he would. One of the reasons I ended up moving out of there was too many of those guys came around, and before they would play and crash, and before they would leave, they would steal something. And I finally, that's one of the things I finally got fed up when I moved out of there after about 7 months. But Sonny was one of the guys that used to come by there, and I remember him being just a calm and good cat. There was a drummer named Vinny Ruggiero. Vinny was like a disciple of Philly Joe.
How do you spell Ruggiero?
I think it's R-U-G-E-R-I-O. There might be a double G, you know. Ruggiero is
okay.
Vinny, and he was a big guy. And as I say, he was a pal of Philly Joe. And he would always be around, like, have a drum for sale. He was a drummer, too. But he would always have a drum for sale. I think a lot of times it was Philly Joe's equipment that he just wanted. Because Philly Joe would get equipment at they would give him equipment, and I think he would have Vinny go turn it into cash for him.
I'm really interested in this junkie stealing things.
Yeah.
Thing.
Well, it's one of the weaknesses is it was a place to go and get off the streets, and there was a lot of good musicians that were living on the streets, and things would just be missing, you know. We'd have, and the junkie mentality is to do whatever, take whatever they can to get some money to get what they want and what they need. I mean, I had a record player gone and pieces of clothing and a cymbal. And I don't know which person took it, but it's just that, it's just the temptation for people that are hurting and needing some cash and seeing something there. And even to take it from someone who's providing them almost a haven for a while, you know, and still not being able to resist that temptation because of the terrible need that's created by that mm-hmm. by that junkiness.
And so that was one reason why you moved out.
One of the reasons. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't the real hard bebopper as a lot of those guys that wanted to come there and play all the time. You know, I was more into different areas of music. Like I was traveling, I was going on the road with big bands, you know. And my first summer, the whole the first summer I was living at the loft, I had a job 6 nights a week at a nightclub out in New Jersey. So I wouldn't get there. I wouldn't get there until like midnight or so, you know, by the time. And I'd come in with my tux on, and a lot of the people that were there living on the streets were really, well, I'm not one of them because I'm doing these, what they called uptown gigs. You know? But I was very fortunate. I mean, I was only in town. The first day I was in New York, I was walking down 52nd Street, and I ran into a guy that I was a sideman with in a band in Washington, D.C. And he was a leader on a restaurant called the Chanticleer Restaurant in Orange, New Jersey. And his drummer was leaving, so he offered me the job. So I was, the first day in New York, I got a 6-night-a-week job, which lasted for about the first 6 months. And the next thing I know, I moved into the loft. So here I am in town, only a matter of days, and I've got a 6-night-a-week job, and I'm living in this loft where all these players are coming all the time, and in the midst of, you know, this playing and living in the heart of what could be considered the fast New York, jazz players. You know, they're all coming around there. So and I got to know a lot of people in a very short time, and plus not going around to everyone and having to ask for work, because I'm new in town and I've got a job.
Right.
So it worked out really well. It helped, got me started there really, and connections I made in the loft were good for me for all the years
right.
I was in New York. I met a lot of guys. There's a lot of guys in there. You know, it turned out really like Ronnie Cuber. I'm sure. Have you spoken to Ronnie?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's doing really well, is what I can tell.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I think his career's.
Yeah, he's the baritone sax. I mean, people out here, he's their idol. You know, I know players that Ronnie's their idol. And Pete Yellen, as far as I know, is, you know, like, just going on to become one of the best session players and most wanted players in New York. There used to be a bass player named Dudley Watkins.
Watson.
Dudley Watson, yeah. Sometimes I get him mixed up with Doug. There's a Doug Watson.
Watkins, yeah.
Yeah, Dudley Watson was an albino,
mm-hmm.
and he used to be there all the time. And he, I don't know if he had a place to live or not, but he certainly gave the appearances of being at loose ends all the time. But he was there night after night after night. I mean, I remember one night that he was. Nobody was ever drunk there. If you were intoxicated, you were high, and he fell on my drum and broke my drum, and I had to take it, get a guy repair it for me. But
yeah.
he just fell on it. But Dudley was there a lot.
After you moved out, did you go back for sessions or?
No, I didn't. It was shortly after that. That's when Jimmy brought. You know, Sandy to live there, and they made it more into like a living quarters. You know, the way it used to be, there was in the back where you came up the back where the kitchen area, there was a bed there, and that was my bed. And up in front, right next to where we played, there was an extra little room where there was a bed in there. You know, and that's where Dave lived. And then when Dave moved out, that's where Jimmy lived. And so since I took Gary's place, Gary was living up by the kitchen area, so I took that bed. But then. So it wasn't really, the furnishings were very sparse. There wasn't even any hot water. You know, fortunately it was the summertime, and we took all cold showers. And when it started getting chilly, I was still living there and rolling into October, and I called Dave Young about it. And he told me that he had given Gary Hawkins the money to pay. At first I called the gas company, and they said there was an outstanding bill. And Dave Young told me that he had given Gary Hawkins the money for that bill last year. So I called Gary, who was in Bermuda, and he owned up that, yes, he did, and he sent me the money. And we got the gas turned back on, and all of a sudden we had some heat and some hot water as getting into the winter. And then it was, as I say, long around November or so that I decided to move out. And then Jimmy and Sandy, and they had the baby, and I don't know whether they continued. I know they didn't have the open type sessions that we were having during the summer of 1961 that I was living there, but it wasn't the open house like that, you know, anymore. Maybe if Jimmy might have had a session and invited certain people, then they might have, because that area was still back there where the piano was. But I mean, in the 7 months I lived there, seven, 8 months, it was just strictly open house. You know, again, you had to toss that key out the window, or we didn't leave the, I don't think we left the door open. It wasn't anyone was willing to do that. And I don't think Gene would have liked that either, you know.
Yeah.
It was always like tossing the key out the window, or actually going down and letting someone in.
That's really interesting. I mean, you've given me a lot of new information.
That's great.
I mean, just a lot of those facts about who moved in, who moved out, and mm-hmm. when. Yeah. A lot of that, like Jimmy, you know, Jimmy, he couldn't even remember if it was 1960 or 1961, you know, when he moved in.
Uh-huh.
And so this is really helpful.
Yeah.
Just the factual.
I've often wondered how long that was going on before I moved in, you know.
It started in 1954.
Yeah, I mean, I knew it was had a history, but I didn't know how.
Yeah. There's so many different chapters.
Yeah.
I think after Jimmy moved in, and especially Sandy, and then when they had kids, you know, it definitely changed. And then it seemed to pick back up, at least judging from the tapes. There are a lot of tapes from 63 and 64.
Yeah. I was still in town then, but I never did go. When I got out of there, I never went back, except one time Sandy invited me for dinner. Jimmy was on the road, and it was not too long, because I was going back and saw how they had fixed the place up, and it was livable and cozy even, you know. And the baby was still very little, so it had to be like in the winter of 61, 62.
Okay.
And then, you know, and then I went on, and 63, I got married, and we went into a whole other area of business. I was playing in New York nightclubs and going on the road with bands and Broadway shows and stuff like that.
Sure.
But I never regretted a valuable summer of just playing almost constantly in that loft. Yeah.
Anything that I haven't asked you, or any other thing that you think that I should know about?
Yeah, I'm sorry I don't know more about Gene, you know. He was just there. As I say, I didn't even know his reputation or you know. That.
Well, I think that's a big part of the story, because I don't think he really hung out much. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that, here are some names. Go down this list and see anybody that we haven't talked about.
Gene Allen. I knew Gene, baritone player. Mm-hmm. He'd come there occasionally, but I knew him. He used to play with Woody Herman. And Mose Allison, that's who Ronnie Free, and I never met Mose, and I'll never know if he came to the loft, but I do know that's who Ronnie was playing with. I mean, there's names here like Eddie Burt. I played in How to Succeed in Business without him. Paul Blay, he used to come to the loft. In fact, I think he had his own loft, and then down to the next block or something.
Right.
He and Steve Lacy, they had, I don't know if Steve Lacy is his name on here. Yeah, Steve Lacy is here. I mean, I know a lot of Ruby Braff, who just passed away. Last time I saw Ruby was in New Orleans. We were at a place called Felix's Oyster House, and Ruby came in. He just happened to be in town at the same time. Bob Brookmeyer. I don't remember these. Jay Cameron, he used to come to the loft. He used to have this little three-wheeled Italian car or something. It was like, I don't know what it was, but it was three wheels, and it was just enough room for him and the back hatch in the back for his baritone sax. I remember Jay. I hadn't thought of him in a long time. Dolph Castellano, I think it is. The last I heard of Dolph, he was in Miami, piano player. Dolph Castellano. I mean, Teddy Charles, I know him, but he wasn't from the loft. And Al Cohen would be mainly at Hall's place. And I remember one morning driving around, one Sunday morning, when I first went to New York, I had a car. I had this 1960 Plymouth Fury, big, because I got it on the road with the Dean Hudson band. And I remember one Sunday morning with Gary Hawkins, who was the guy whose place I was to take, driving up Sixth Avenue, and there was Al Cohn just walking around. He was probably coming from Hall's or something. And we offered to ask him if he wanted to go for a ride, smoke some pot, and he didn't want to do it. But Al was around there a lot.
Yeah.
I used to smoke pot. I never did get into hard drugs. But we all smoked pot in those days. And,
yeah. I mean, some guys have said it was like drinking coffee up in the loft.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it was just part. It was always there. Yeah.
What was the pot like? Would it be a community stash, or would somebody?
No, an individual would have, and either share it, or if he didn't share it, we didn't know he had it.
Would there ever be any animosity because somebody else was smoking everybody else's pot and never bringing...
I don't remember anything like that. Most animosity is when someone wanted... when someone wanted to play and couldn't get to play. And horn players would always get to play. They just wait their turn and just play court. A lot of times drummers would get into arguments with each other. They wanted a turn to play.
Right.
Or rhythm section players who... But that's the only animosity I ever was aware of. And if anyone was like, you know, like really shooting heroin or something, they didn't do it out in the open. You know, it was like pot, you just smoke it, you know, when you're there. If you've got a joint or a pipe, you pass it around. But if anyone was going to to turn on with hard drugs, they would do it privately.
Mm-hmm.
Chick Corea, well, he never came to the loft, but... that band I mentioned, that weekend that we went on the road with the Billy May band, that they wouldn't let Lynn Holiday come. Chick was the piano player on that. Then he went on to greater things. And of course, Bill Crow, Ronnie Cooper, I mentioned. Manny Duran, trumpet player, he used to be a Pot Connection. Yeah, Manny Duran. John Eardley, I know who he is, but I didn't know him from the pot. I mean, from the loft. Joe Farrell used to be there all the time. Joe Farrell. And Dave Frischberg. I can't remember Dave coming to the loft, but I certainly, he used to play. He was the piano player with Al in the suit, so he might have been at the Hall's place more. But I don't recall him coming to the loft. Henry Grimes, I said, the bass player, you mentioned you're going to see him. I remember him from the loft. He used to come there quite often.
Yeah.
Jim Hall, no. Gary Hawkins is the guy whose place I took. I don't know whatever happened to him. Have you ever heard of him again?
I think he died.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Sad. Joe Hunt, he was the drummer that was playing with Dave Sibley when they were playing with Frankie Randall.
Okay.
A lot of these names are big names I'm just skipping over because whoever. I'm just looking for people. Is that what you want me to, people I knew would
yeah,
have come,
just anybody,
come to
I
six?
Was just, yeah. I thought maybe it might jog a memory about somebody.
Yeah.
And then this Dolph Castellano tip that you had heard, he lived in Miami. You know that. So I used that to try to find him.
I went to Miami in about 1968. I was playing with Sammy Kaye's band, and we went down there to be on the Jackie Gleason show. And I used to be Dolph. After I left that loft, I moved into a little pad up on West 73rd Street. And upstairs from me lived a bass player named Chuck Andrus, who was with Woody Herman's band at the time. And his wife Beverly was friends with Dolph's wife, and Dolph was out of town a lot. And I remember he wasn't sending them money, and they were like living at a hotel and he wasn't sending them money. And when I went to Miami, I looked them up, and they were living in Miami then. So, and that was 19, you know, like the late 60s. So that he may be anywhere now.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Parkhurst, here's a name. We went to New York together because we had been on that Dean Hudson band. Now Jack is dead, you know. But he did have a nervous breakdown in New York City. He first came there. He ended up with a gig. He went on the road with Charlie Barnett band. He came back to town, and he just a number of us had to call. He had a friend that lived out on Long Island, and Jack really just freaked out and got catatonic and laid in bed and wouldn't move. And we had his friend, who was a school teacher in Long Island, send a psychiatrist to see him. And the psychiatrist committed him to, I don't know, committed him to a mental institution.
Yeah.
And they actually did shock treatments on him. And then when he got out of there, like, he was just like, it had, the shock treatments had removed his ability to play the saxophone. You know, all the it had burned out his knowledge, you know, of his instincts and things that, you know, like, you develop. I guess that's what shock treatment is for.
Yeah.
And that's the last time I saw him, and he was like, I had seen him, and he had was back in, had been released, and he was very angry that this had been done. But this friend of his, you know, called his parents and got permission and everything. It isn't like one of us made a decision. Yeah. And then I know that maybe 10 years or so that I heard that he had died. I'm going to let the machine take that. Okay. That's okay. Freddie Redd used to come around and play. Guys like Bill Potts, he never came to the loft, but I knew him. Jim Ryder used to come to the loft. I first met Jim when I was playing at strip clubs in Baltimore. And Jim was one of those guys who could play saxophone and piano. And he used to be the sub. Sometimes he would play saxophone and sometimes piano. And his brother, his friend was Gary Klein, and they had both had come from, I forget the name of the town in Pennsylvania now, they had come to Baltimore to study at Peabody. And then this Jim Ryder, we all ended up in New York, but Jim was playing with Jerry Mulligan's band, and he got really strung out too.
Do you know if he's still around?
No, he died.
Okay.
He died in the 60s. Well,
okay.
And the last time I saw him was like one of the White Rose bars, and he was just about crying. He kept telling me that he lost his nerve. And I've lost my nerve. I can't do anything. I can't hardly just go out on the street.
Wow.
And he couldn't play anymore. And shortly after that, he died. In his 60s, he was still, you know, a young guy. He must have been in his 30s. But Jimmy was... sad case. He was a good arranger, and he could play piano and sax and everything, but he just couldn't cope.
Yeah.
And the drugs didn't help.
Yeah, sure.
Jerry Siegel, he used to come to the loft. He's also known as Doc Siegel, the drummer. Jerry Siegel.
Yeah.
Have you met him?
No.
Yeah. I first saw him. He was playing with the Pete Rugolo Orchestra, It came to Baltimore doing a concert, and he was the drummer. You know, Pete Rugolo wrote for Stan Kenton, and he had a very progressive orchestra of his own.
But, where does he live now, Jerry Siegel?
Well, he's probably still in New York. If he's still alive. I mean, when I was
in the, I think he might be dead.
Yeah, when I was in the loft, I was 35, and you know, when I went to New York, I was 35, and Doc could have been like, he was looked like 50-ish then, you know. So he was a good 10 years older than me.
Yeah.
And I'm 77 now, so he could, if he's still around.
Yeah.
No. Let's see. Dick Sheridan. Now, Dick didn't come to the loft, but Dick was a drummer, and he ended up being a bartender at Charlie's Tavern. And I don't know what happened to him, but I knew he played for many years with Bobby Short. He was Bobby Short's drummer. And they had a gig at the Carlisle Hotel, where Bobby's still there. But in the 60s, Dick was with him a good 10 years.
Yeah.
And he also would be a bartender at Charlie's Tavern, where we all hung out on 52nd Street. Did anyone mention Charlie's Tavern?
Yeah, yeah.
That was the place. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Jim and Andy's.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Jimmy Stevenson, of course. George Saran. And I'm not sure of that spelling either. And I remember him. I'm not sure whether he's a piano player or a saxophone player. And the name like Nick Travis, he's just a famous trumpet player, but I never knew him from Dudley Watson is on here. I'll be darned, yeah. Mel Zellman, there's one. Yeah, Mel Zellman used to come around a lot. Mel Zellman was a drummer, and he had been on the road and got into a car accident, and he had a metal plate in his head, and it affected him mentally. He would be very erratic from time to time. But he used to hang out at the loft a lot. In fact, one time I went to a session up on in Germantown, New York. It's like 86th Street. And Phil Woods was having a session there, say like Thursday night or something. And I wanted to play, and Mel Zellman wanted to play. We both jumped up on the bandstand, and Mel knocked me off the bandstand, and I broke bone in my foot. I was hobbling around New York, and still had to work, because in those days I had no kind of health insurance or anything.
Right.
So I just wrapped it up with an ACE bandage until it healed. And it never really healed right. It doesn't cause me any trouble, but years later I was going to a chiropractor. He noticed that the bone had been broken and not healed correctly. But that was Mel Zellman. He knocked me off that bandstand. There used to be a pretty chick who I really liked, used to come around to the loft. Her name was Jeannie Cunningham.
Yeah. I wondered if, she was akin to, I mean, that's not the same Jean Cunningham who was married to Bradley Cunningham.
I don't know who she was married. She was married, and that was her married name. I think Jean Cunningham, I'm not sure whether that was her maiden name or, but she was married to a guy. She was a pianist.
I
think from San Francisco.
You know, I think that's Bradley Cunningham's wife, from Bradley's, you know, the famous Greenwich Village piano bar that was... It was probably after you left New York.
But uh-huh.
It opened in the late 60s, early 70s, and lasted just until a few years ago.
Yeah. Well, Gina used to come around a lot. She would call, is anything happening? And she would come by and play.
I'm going to track her down.
It's quite a list of guys. A lot of some of these guys I know other than the loft, like Bill Potts. He's a piano player and arranger. And I remember one time he wrote some arrangements for a chick named Tina Louise. And we all got together at a studio and went over, played the arrangements for him. He got us some money, paid us, and we tried out his arrangements, and she liked them. Al Levitt is a drummer, but I don't connect him with the loft.
Any more other stories about Lynn Holiday?
Not really.
Okay.
Yeah,
the couple you told were great.
Yeah. Lynn was, I can just still see, I can remember one time when he and I got into like a friendly, it was a wrestling match in the loft. And I was surprised, and he said, "You're surprised how strong I am, aren't you?" Because he was, you know, I thought he looked like he was going to break any minute. He was so thin. And I had just like carried my trap case up five flights. You know, and I said something about being strong, and he said we just got into a little wrestling match, and he was proud of how strong he was, even though he knew that I knew he was strung out. You know,
yeah.
He still has some strength going for him there.
Yeah.
Maybe living on the street made him wiry. And
yeah. Well, Frank, this has been great. Really, I've got a few things that I've. Haven't had.
Yeah.
I really appreciate
that. Well, it's wonderful. I'm really pleased to help, and it's a part of my life where I've always considered it a special part. So I love to talk about it. And if I come up with any other reminiscences, I'll email you.
Here's one other thing. One last thing. If you could just describe the stairwell and kind of the physical condition of the building as you remember it. anything about that?
Well, I remember the stairs just went like. I mean, I'm a guy that had to carry a set of drums up to the fifth floor, you know, so it was just like bleak. And one time, my brother and my sister-in-law came to visit me in New York, and I can remember taking them up those stairways, and they were reacting like I was taking them through like, it was Phantom of the Opera kind of a scene or something. They were really aghast at where I was taking them, where I was living, and going up that. Those just it wasn't rickety, but it was well worn, and you know no one painted the walls or did any maintenance to them. It was just like a funky functional stairway to get to the top. I mean, all, you know, just up and around each floor, you know, and then when you got to the top, then it continued on up to the roof. And the first time I really became aware of that was when Lynn and his girlfriend had used that as an entrance.
Yeah.
But then it was nice. I mean, you could go up there on a roof, you know, and like there's the Empire State Building, and you know there's like the skyline of Manhattan. It was like it was real, really can't get much more New Yorker than that. Yeah. Going up. In fact, I was in New York this last December, and I was with my grandson, and we were at the Empire State Building, and I was trying to point out to him where the loft was, you know, right down in there. I don't think I really did exactly pinpoint it because I wasn't sure which was 28th and which was 29th Street. But I was pointing it out to him. And there's been times when I've gone back to New York and I've just gone down there and stood across the street and looked up there and just like remember, God, is that, did that really happen? Did those days really pass? It used to be the flower district.
Right.
In the morning, we'd be up there playing and like, you know, dawn and all the flower trucks. People would make all these places would come alive with flowers. It was the flower district,
right.
And I also heard one time, I read something just a couple years ago that the street that was Tin Pan Alley was right there.
28th Street.
Yeah, between 6th and 7th.
That's right.
Which was right there.
That's right.
And there was a little coffee shop on the corner where we used to get like coffee or an egg cream, or I used to get the Kaiser Rolls with butter. That was a breakfast more times than not. So that was the and I didn't know that when I was living there, and just within the last year or so I read that was actually that block was Tin Pan Alley.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's right. I can't think of anything else. If I think of something, I can email you.
Oh, yeah, and if I think of something, I'll email you, too, because I think it's a great thing that you're doing, because, I mean, that's a historical place, and, some of the world's greatest musicians went through there.
Yeah.